Past profound, wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000,000,000 kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. In the Buddhist calendar, in the Soto Zen calendar, February 15th is Nehan, or Nirvana Day. So last Wednesday was Nehan. That is the day that Shakyamuni is said to have died and passed into Nirvana. So we know in our tradition that Buddha was born a prince of the Shakya tribe. He was born in about 400 or 500, the date varies, BCE. In northern India, in an area which is now Nepal. We know that he left home at the age of 29, began searching for answers to the problems of life and death. This is a greatly condensed version of his life. We know he had many experiences, many sufferings, many questions. But he went out and did his ascetic practices for 6 years. He did a lot of fasting. He did a lot of not indulging the body. He realized at the end of that, at some point, that the mind, his mind was not any less disturbed than it was when he started. So he said, this is not the way. So a village maiden came and offered him some milk and gruel, which he ate. Kind of got his strength back a little bit. Went to a grove near Bodh Gaya, sat down under a tree and woke up. So there's the Reader's Digest version of the life of Buddha up to that point. So he was about age 35 when that happened for him. He went on to teach until he was about 80 years old, and his life came to an end, and he died. So we have a picture on the altar today, which is a little unusual for us, but this kind of picture is called Nehanzu. This is a picture of his passing. And if you haven't had a chance to look at it, I invite you at some point during the day to come up and see. We see the Buddha lying on his side, surrounded by his disciples. We see him in the grove with the trees. We see the full moon overhead. It was a sort of a clear, calm night when this was all happening. So this is a fairly standard image of passing the Buddha. So the information that we have about this scene, about his death, about this story, comes from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which is just about the longest sutra in the Pali Canon, which I think is kind of interesting. Here's the Buddha dying, and this is where, you know, this is the longest sutra practically we have. There's a lot going on here. There's really a lot happening. This is a really important event in our history and in our calendar. In Japan, Nehan was a big, you know, a big deal. The noon service we didn't do in the regular Dharma hall. We did off to the side in front of a huge scroll with a picture like this. And we chanted this long sutra. We also did a kind of a special ceremony. There was scattering of flower petals, there was extra incense. You know, it's a major event in our calendar. So there are many kind of attendant teachings that go with this sutra or go with this time. The sutra itself deals with the events leading up to his death itself, and then the things that come immediately after it. So it's kind of an arc of the story here. So if you look at this picture, everything looks calm, everything looks serene, despite the fact that the Buddha is dying. And there are some grieving disciples. But we do see the calmness of this natural setting. We see a few clouds. We see a full moon. And our impression is that although the Buddha is dying, in some way he's free from suffering. Right? He's lying here. You know, he's kind of come to the end of his life. But there's this sense, there's this feeling about this picture and about this story that there's a freedom from suffering. And really when we look at a picture like this and we think about this story, I think there's some inspiration there for us to face death or to face any circumstance with a certain degree of equanimity. Many things in our life can feel like death. So it's not only about our physical death. Can we face the circumstances of our lives with some kind of equanimity? So nirvana is a Sanskrit word, I think I've mentioned before. It has the feeling of extinguishing, like a flame going out. So it's, you know, extinguishing of suffering, it's also extinguishing perhaps of human life, which is what's happening here in this picture. But of course, you know, nirvana doesn't only mean death. Here the Buddha, the physical form of the Buddha died, but the teachings go on. So in that sense, he's still here. The teachings are still here. Nirvana is really an attainment of a state that goes beyond living and dying, beyond life and death. And Toned may be addressing this some more tomorrow in her talk when she's here. But for today, we can sort of set the scene and think something about this story. So all the fires of delusion have gone out. When we get to nirvana, all the fires of the delusion, the fires of the suffering have gone out. You know, the anger, the dissatisfaction, the confusion, the suffering. Those things have been extinguished. So, of course, the dead are peaceful and free from delusion, right? So, in Japan, when we do a funeral service, it's very much like the service for becoming a monk. You know, we give precepts, we ordain this person, sort of in absentia, if you will. And after people die there, they are considered Buddhas. The word for that is hotoke, which is a word for Buddha. These folks are Buddhas because they've gone to nirvana. They're free from suffering. They're free from delusion. And we can have gratitude for them and have respect for them and take some inspiration for them. But our practice while we're living, of course, is to calm the mind and to liberate ourselves. And Shakyamuni showed us that it's possible. He showed us how to do it. So we can have some gratitude for him on this occasion that marks his physical death. So his death shows us one of the very basic teachings of our practice, which is impermanence. You know, that all life must end. You know, all things are impermanent. And the last thing he told his disciples, one of the last teachings he gave to his disciples, is the quote that's in the entryway this week. "Behold, O brethren, the final extinction of the Tathagata will take place before long. Therefore, be you lamps unto yourselves. Rely on yourselves and do not rely on external help. All component things must grow old and be dissolved again. Seek ye for that which is permanent and work out your salvation with diligence." That's a fairly famous teaching. Probably you've heard this before. So he's using his own death as an example of impermanence. But there's some other things we can learn from this story. There's some other kinds of teachings we can take from this. We see that the Buddha had real compassion for the sorrow of his disciples and for other people that were involved in this story. Because it's said that the reason he died was that he ate some food which was given to him, which was either poisoned or had gone bad. Not deliberately poisoned, but there was something wrong with it. Some stories say it was mushrooms, some stories say it was pork. We're not really sure what it was. But it was a layperson who offered him this food in all good conscience, you know. And the Buddha says to this layperson, "Don't feel remorse about this. This was not your fault. Don't feel bad." Because you can imagine, oh my gosh, this thing that I offered the Buddha killed him. So this guy is feeling terrible. And Buddha says, "It's okay. It's not your fault. You didn't mean it." You know, he has great compassion for this. He could have been terrifically angry, you know, having a lot of suffering around it. And so we see this wonderfully magnanimous mind. We see this real compassion for someone who did not really intend to cause harm. You see later on in the sutra, there's some karmic consequences to this. You know, he wasn't allowed to practice in ways that other people were allowed to practice. But there was not anger. There was not acting out. There was simply this compassion. So we see this forgiveness. We see this magnanimity. So let's consider what this final teaching of Buddha says to us. "Behold, O brethren, the final extinction of the Tathagata will take place before long. Therefore, be you lamps unto yourselves, rely on yourselves, and do not rely on external help." So his point is, although he's gone, that people can and should keep practicing. He's telling his disciples, you know, just because I'm not here doesn't mean you should stop. You know, continue your practice, continue your commitment to practice. Don't rely on my own presence to be here. So as he lies dying in this picture, lots of omens start to happen. Lots of sort of specialized things start to happen. Sandalwood powder falls from the sky. Flowers fall from the sky. There's some... the whole universe seems to be paying tribute, you know, giving honor to the Buddha as he's dying. But he says, "But it is not to this extent that the Tathagata is worshipped, honored, respected, venerated, or paid homage to. Rather, the monk, nun, male lay follower, or female lay follower who keeps practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma, who keeps practicing masterfully, who lives in accordance with the Dharma, That is the person who worships, honors, respects, venerates, and pays homage to the Tathagata with the highest homage. So he says, if you really love me, if you really respect me, practice. Put into practice these things that I have taught you, which are not about me. This is the way the world is, and I'm showing you this. So if you really want to honor me, even though I'm dead, even though my physical body is gone, please practice. So, you know, the Buddha himself, of course, can't liberate us. He's showing us how to work with our stuff, how to work with our delusion and our suffering and our pain, and liberate ourselves and liberate others. And we can do that, even though his physical form has changed. So there's a common misperception that I seem to run into, and maybe you have as well, about this quote, be a lamp unto yourself. This doesn't mean that we don't have to listen to other people or take direction. You know, it can be really easy to take that quote and say, well, that means if somebody tells me to do something that I don't think is comfortable or that I don't like very much, I pull out this quote out of my back pocket and say, oh, well, but I have to listen to my own inner wisdom and be a lamp unto myself, and therefore I don't have to do what you tell me. That's not what the Buddha is saying. You know, but it's just this human condition. As soon as we run into something that's challenging, we want to reject that thing. We want to separate ourselves from those circumstances. And we want to pull out this big, broad teaching that says, Buddha says I should do for myself and only listen to myself and not listen to you. Well, no. Of course. If we were able to wake up one day and kind of just liberate ourselves without any direction, that would be great, but most of us can't do that. So we put ourselves into circumstances, into training circumstances, into practice circumstances, where we have the help of other people. And sometimes that means we get challenged, right? You know? If we weren't being challenged, we aren't growing. So, you know, we do have to listen to our own wisdom. But that wisdom is based on direct experience of the universe, of reality, not on our idea about what direct experience is. You know, there's this little subtle kind of covering there. So when we put ourselves into a practice container, whether that's a training temple, a Zen center, some kind of practice circumstance, which is skillfully constructed and skillfully run, and it's a safe place, then we've got to let go of the suffering that comes up from being challenged, you know? We have to have some trust. Don't go into a circumstance which doesn't feel safe to you. You know, that's not skillful, that's not smart. But find people to practice with. Find a sangha or somebody to practice with that feels safe to you. And then see if you can put aside all those things that come up when we're asked to do something which feels uncomfortable or unfamiliar. And I'll tell you, going to Japan and training in a temple, that happened to me all the time because of different culture, different styles. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity to really put aside this defensive thing that comes up. You know. So we have to be careful about not using this teaching, be a lamp unto yourself, in an arrogant kind of way, to shore up the self or to build some concept of self. Because really, if we do, it's just ego, you know, it's just spiritual bypassing. So let's be careful about that. When I was in Japan, in fact, there was one Westerner, there were a number of Westerners there at the time, but one of the Westerners had noticed that every time somebody was told to do something, they just said, hi, hi means yes, you know, hi, and then they go and do it with no question. And this, you know, he's thinking about this and thinking, that doesn't feel right. So he said one day during tea time, he asked Roshi, you know, is it true that every time someone says we should do something, we just say hi and we go do it? I mean, shouldn't we be thinking for ourselves? And Roshi went into a little bit of a teaching about ego, and I could see that this guy didn't make the connection. And Roshi's saying, you have to put aside your ego. And he would ask, but, you know, really, but shouldn't we be, like, thinking for ourselves? I mean, this hi, you know. Well, and I guess he had had some experience where somebody had said, a teacher had said, we should be open to all the experience that comes in. In other words, we shouldn't cut ourselves off from direct experience of whatever's happening. You know, engage with what's going on, and in that way say yes to the universe, say yes to the world. And I can see this practitioner trying to reconcile saying yes to the world and simply doing what you're being told without having a story about it. He was really struggling. It's very interesting. And Roshi kept trying to teach him about ego, and I could see he wasn't getting it. But, you know, in a case like that, no, we shouldn't be thinking for ourselves. If Roshi says go do this, you just go do it. Because it's a safe container, you know. And we go in with that idea. So anyway. Yes, be a lamp unto yourself, but do it based on your wisdom from direct experience, not from arrogance. So anyway, Buddha goes on to say, all component things must grow old and be dissolved again. Seek ye for that which is permanent, and work out your salvation with diligence. So Buddha had a disciple, Ananda. We've heard a lot, I'm sure, about Ananda. Ananda spent a lot of time with the Buddha, attending him and kind of helping him and taking care of him. And when the Buddha is dying, he looks around and Ananda is not there. And he says to some of the other monks, where is Ananda? Go find him. And somebody goes to look for him. Well, poor Ananda is off somewhere weeping because he had not yet achieved awakening. As hard as he'd been practicing, and he spent all this time with his teacher, and others around him had achieved awakening, and he had not. And he's weeping because his feeling is, there's so much I have yet to do, and my beloved teacher is dying. And, I mean, imagine the despair. My heart goes out. Whenever I read this sutra, my heart goes out to this man. Because I'm sure we've all been in a position like that. But the Buddha says, go find Ananda, bring him here. You know, and he talks to him, and he says, you know, I've taught you that all things are impermanent. And that, you know, this body is a conditioned thing. And because of that, how can this not be happening? You know, how can this dying not be happening? You had to know at some point. You know, we're all going to end up like this. So, you know, you have to know that this is the way it is. What else can we expect? He says, but, you know, keep practicing. Because you will wake up. It doesn't matter that I'm physically not here. And he goes on to tell all the other disciples about what a wonderful practitioner Ananda is. It was really encouraging him. You know, here's this compassion. So he's dying, but he's still taking care of his disciples and saying, please practice. It'll be okay. You know, you're doing a good job. Hang in there. So all component things, or conditioned things, must grow old and be dissolved again. So conditioned things, we know, are things that are dependent on other things. Everything arises from something. So these are conditioned things. So conditioned things are made up of parts. And eventually, they fall apart. You know, they dissolve. And they return to the parts from which they came. So people are made up of five skandhas. We know about the five skandhas. Form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. Where do we hear about this?
Sutra.
Heart Sutra. So every day when we do the Heart Sutra, we're right in the middle of form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. So quick review, form, some material that we can sense, right? Feeling is the sensation we get when the senses somehow make contact with that form. Perception, we recognize something because we've seen it before. Oh, that's a cat, I've seen one before. And, oh, that's a shoe, I've seen one before. So there's this recognition that we know what things are. Formation is about choice. What do we do with that information? So our attitudes, our predilections, our biases, our prejudices, things we're interested in, things we're not interested in. Also, volitional action. What action do we choose to take? So, you know, what do we choose to do with this information? How do we choose to feel about it? What action do we choose to take? Finally, consciousness, which is the interaction of the senses and the objects. So this is what we do with what we sense. And the eye sees the table. You know, nose smells the incense. So the interaction of all of these consciousnesses is what gives us the idea that there's a permanent abiding self. Right? So we can see out of the five shaky skandhas comes this idea of self. We can see that this is a shaky foundation, right? I mean, when we look closely, it's not built on much. And yet somehow it persists. So, just like all conditioned things, the self can't remain forever, the body can't remain forever, death and dissolution have to occur. So when we have some insight into the illusion of this self, it feels like death, doesn't it? Maybe you've had some experience, maybe in your practice, maybe on the cushion or off the cushion. This self we've carefully constructed starts to dissolve. We start to see that it's not based on a firm foundation. And what's left when that happens? That is a scary, scary thing. You know, that's existential crisis right there. Because we so depend on this idea of ourselves. So, you know, if that's not who we are, who are we? What is this? This thing? What is this? it can feel like looking over a precipice. You can't see the bottom, you know? I can remember a time when I was feeling that way. You know, this shaky self that I had built was starting to dissolve. There were some ceremonies I had to do which I didn't see how I was going to get through it. I didn't know how. I couldn't imagine having done it, because it was so much scary stuff. I couldn't imagine being on the other side. It was the first time in my life I'd ever had that experience, and it was a real unwrapping of the self. Who am I on the other side of these ceremonies? I don't know. I can't visualize who that is. It was very interesting. I was having these pictures in my mind like I had been shot. I was lying on the sidewalk bleeding to death. I mean, it just felt like everything was unraveling. Maybe you've had some experience like this. It can be really scary stuff. So it's not inappropriate to think about that aspect of our practice at a time when we're considering the Buddha's death. You know? So this is not just this nice story that happened, or not so nice, that happened 2,500 years ago, part of our folklore that we can just pull out once a year and say, well, isn't that interesting? This is our practice. This is our life and death. You know? Every time an expectation gets challenged, that's ego death. That's the death of something. How do we let go of that? How do we practice with that? So, because our idea of ourselves is also quite heavily based on our relationships with other people or with things we encounter in our lives, when a beloved teacher dies, or a relative, or a family pet, or anything, it's not fun. It's almost as scary. And yet we knew it was inevitable, right? I know at some point my lovely little dog and cat upstairs are not going to be here anymore. And when they die, I'm going to grieve for them. You know? It's inevitable. And yet somehow it's very hard. So how do we work with that? So, you know, we can empathize with poor Ananda. He's gone off into a nearby building. He's leaning on the door jamb and sobbing because his beloved teacher is dying. I mean, you can just feel that, can't you? We've all had that experience. So it's not fair. There's work to do. I need things from my teacher, and you know, here's this relationship, and it's not. I don't want it to be over yet. You know, it's not fair. It's very hard. And yet, we know all things are impermanent. No one lives forever. Our circumstances change. Seek ye for that which is permanent, and work out your salvation with diligence. So here's what the Buddha is telling us to do in the midst of these circumstances. So that which is permanent is that which is unconditioned. We've talked about things that were conditioned. So we can appreciate those things which are conditioned. We can interact with them. We can practice with them, live with them, work with them. And yet, no. They're conditioned. They're impermanent. So how can we sort of point ourselves toward that which is unconditioned, which is Buddha nature, or ultimate reality, or suchness, or whatever name you like to give it? It is not nameable. If we name something, if we give it characteristics, those are bound by space and time. That which is unconditioned is not bound by space and time, and yet we have to call it something so that we can practice with it a little bit. So seek for that which is permanent by sitting zazen, by following precepts, by cultivating wisdom, the wisdom that comes from direct experience. So we need to make a commitment to practice in some form, 5 minutes a day on a cushion. Whatever it looks like for you, Buddha is saying, please make a commitment, even though I'm gone, to continue to practice. So that we can appreciate the people and things that come into our lives and then be prepared to let go of them when it's time for them to grow old and dissolve and return to the parts that make them up. So it seems to me that at the time of his death, Buddha is reminding us how to live. So this is not a sad story. This is an encouraging story. I want to leave you with a little poem. It was written by a Japanese poet, Matsusei Seisei, who lived from 1869 to 1937, and he wrote a poem for Nirvana Day. Mono ni koi, samenu ne mimi ya, yuri kyo gyo, which means clinging to things. The final sermon of Buddha is not for my ears. So what would you like to say this morning about Nirvana or whatever's on your mind?
You just read that little poem again in English.
Mm-hmm. Clinging to things, the final sermon of Buddha is not for my ears. He's stuck. He's still clinging to things. He can't hear this teaching.
Did you read that quote you read right in the very beginning?
Mm-hmm. The one that's in the...
From the Buddha.
The one that's in the entryway? Yes. Behold, O brethren, the final extinction of the Tathagata will take place before long. Therefore, be ye lamps unto yourselves. Rely on yourselves and do not rely on external help. All component things must grow old and be dissolved again. Seek ye for that which is permanent and work out your salvation with diligence.
Go back there. Mm-hmm. Seek ye for that which is
permanent. Yes, things which are not, that which is not conditioned.
But we are impermanent. Everything is impermanent. Why do we seek for permanence?
We seek for that which is not conditioned. So, ultimate reality, Buddha nature, suchness, whatever you'd like to call it, is the one thing on which we can rely. And that's beyond...
I'm confused. I thought one of the basic tenets of Buddhism is impermanence.
All conditioned things are impermanent. So what is unconditioned? There is something beyond that which is conditioned. Something which does not arise from other things. And that is this suchness, this ultimate truth. And this is why we can't get our minds around it. Because it's unconditioned, so we can't... It's not bound by space and time. So anything we try to call it, which binds it in space and time, doesn't quite hit the mark. And yet, that's what we're trying to experience. Which is why it's why this is about direct experience. It's why wisdom is your direct experience. It cannot be about your idea of what this unconditioned is. And it's unconditioned, like with a capital U, you know, or whatever you want to call it. The unborn sometimes is used.
There was a book by Tolstoy where it wasn't a novel or anything. It was like one of his last books was like it was called A Calendar of Wisdom, and he had collected from many different religious scriptures from different religions and philosophical writings, all sorts of like wise sayings, and each day of the calendar year would have a theme to it. And in one of the last few days, I've been going through it day by day, and one of the last few days had to do with this idea that a spiritual journey was about looking, not looking at things which are physical, which and looking towards things which was referred to as eternal, that are not. It just kind of rings true exactly with what we're talking about. It's like not something that can be, that I think some of the passages had to do with most people being concerned with that which they can. That has to do with their senses and the physical world and their physical need, their physical desires, and the spiritual had to do with looking for what's referred to as the eternal, which is something not physical.
Mm-hmm. And as fast as we are pointing ourselves toward finding whatever this unconditioned is, we also can't ignore the conditioned world. You know, one is not better than the other. We have to carry both of these things. So, in our, you know, sometimes we talk about the spiritual journey or that we're on some kind of a path, and of course we're not really. This is all we got. So, there's no progress. There's nowhere to go. And yet, you know, as we're practicing, we make an attempt to have some insight into what this unconditioned is, and yet it takes the conditioned world for us to do that. So we need this body as the ground of that practice, and yet it's impermanent, and yet it dissolves. So isn't this interesting? We have to use one to transcend the other. Both of you have something to say. I don't mind who goes first.
So the unconditioned, that's the same as the unmanifest.
Mm.
So weren't we reading in this book club, or in this Jungian book club, and there's this obscure quote by Jung where he says that nothing can come out of nothing, something can't come out of nothing, and he says that whatever it becomes manifest, there's already some kind of spiritual archetype or framework or something, you know, out of which it comes.
Well, there's some element of dependent origination in there, you know. Huh? All things, there is some element of dependent origination in there. All things arise from other things. You know, conditioned things arise from conditions, causes and conditions. So what is beyond that? What is beyond life and death? That is the unconditioned.
So the unmanifest, though it manifests itself, is not dependent on the manifestation.
Right.
But the manifestation is dependent on the unmanifest.
They are not separate. Uh-huh. They are not separate.
The other question was, when he says, be a light unto yourself, I've read in a few places the quote, be an island unto yourself. Is that a different sutra, or is that a different interpretation?
I
think Han has this song, I'm an island unto myself.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. Like, I'm guessing that it's not a direct translation of this sutra. It may be a teaching, and I could be wrong. I've always heard this sutra translated, be a light or be a lamp unto yourself. Because lamp or light is about wisdom. You know, it's a image about wisdom. So, you know, where is your wisdom coming from? Your own personal direct experience of reality. Yeah.
Thich Nhat Hanh might have meant that in terms of reacting, be violent unto yourself. Well, interesting, on the way here this morning, I had, from where I came to here, just a clip of hearing Michael Feldman, and he had a physicist on. And interestingly, Michael Feldman said, I don't understand, because the physicist was saying energy and form are the same thing. And he said, explain that. You know, he was kind of trying to do that in terms of universe terms and physicist terms, and he kept questioning him. And he said, but where is the ultimate for, I mean, what is, you know, and they have this banter back and forth. And he said, well, the theory is that we could possibly name that. I think it starts with a P, pixel or something like that. It's not a pixel, but some other term. We have not found it. We don't know if we'll ever find it. But if we do, then we'll name it. But anyway, he went back and forth with
this. Bogen particle or something?
I thought it was with the P, but I
don't know. Higgs boson.
Higgs boson.
Maybe that's wrong.
Well,
no, it's not about the smallest. It's like what's behind energy and form, which are the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where does energy and form come from?
Sure.
Kind of. Yeah.
So you see bodhicitta arising for people struggling with this thing. But I mean, it just shows this is such a universal thing. We're all struggling with this. You know, that's very interesting.
And it was in a comic form, but...
Yes, but we come at it from, you know, some of us come at it from practice, and some come at it from science, and some come at it from literature. And I mean, there's just, you know, it's such a huge question. Big, big question.
It's a problem because, you know, it's the limitation of the human mind.
Exactly.
And it's kind of like you can't get there from here.
That's right.
You can only say, I'm here.
That's right. And at some point when we sit... we get some direct insight into it. The human mind can't conceive of it. Therefore, that's not the gateway in. We have to let go of all of that, which is not the way we've trained ourselves to think or learn or acquire information or whatever for all these many decades of our lives. It's a whole radically different approach.
I think the human mind can get there from here, but it's like, you know, that program of the human mind, that pattern, thinking and all that. And
conceptualizing.
Yeah, and like looking at it from a place of me, you know, it's like, no, that key doesn't open the lock.
That's right.
But the mind is, you know.
Certainly, we have no other ground from which to practice. We can't get there any other way. We just can't use the mind the way we're used to using the mind.
Yeah.
We can't use understanding in the way that we're used to using understanding. So, but I mean, you see... You know, you hear this being these folks on the radio, and you see them turn out, you know, how do you grapple with this? Sit down. Sit down.
It seems to me at a time, in terms of a religious understanding, that there are so many elements of religion that are going more and more solidified into a form, which is creating more and more difficulties. It's almost like you see a huge split between something that the Zen practice and the traditional form of religion. It's more and more solidified into form.
And yet, the form, we can use the form to transcend the form. So, you know, many gateways in, many pathways in. There are ways to use the form to transcend the form. So I think it's very interesting. And my guess is in many religions you see, you know, the very traditional form-based practice, and then there might be some other branch which is very not based on that, because there are multiple gateways in. So I think it's fine to adapt the form and to modify the form as long as we understand what that form is about and what it was for. You know, and I'm just kind of, because then we're throwing away all the handrails. Then we're kind of adrift.
Yeah.
Then we really are relying on what's my idea of what I'm trying to do here and where I'm trying to go, because we're kind of rejecting all the guidance that we've had. So, you know, we need to be flexible and not just cling to things because they're there. At the same time, you know, how do we use the form to transcend the form?
That would be the not very skillful form of using yourself in your own head.
Right? Exactly. Right. That's right. That's right. You know, yes, we and our experience are critical, central, very important, and how do we do that in a skillful way? So.
Is that unconditioned the same as the deathless?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, beginningless beginning and endless end, because if we can't bind it in space and time, it won't die. It must be deathless. It's also birthless. That's why the unborn or the deathless are terms that are kind of stuck onto this unconditioned that we can't conceive of. Anything else on this today? Chuck, I'm glad you're here, because last time you asked about whether it was possible to do several practices at the same time, or in your life to have several kinds of practices. And I said it might be possible, but we would need to be very, very careful, because there are perhaps different interpretations of things. And if you can manage that, more power to you. And later on I realized where I was actually going with that. So let me hit it one more time. I think whatever practice it is that's in front of us right now, we have to engage in it 100% and just do that. And I think sometimes that's not so easy if we're doing multiple practices in our lives, because we want to bring in other bits, you know, such that we're doing, for 5 minutes we're doing one thing and then for 10 minutes we're doing something else. So it occurred to me later that I think if I was presented with that, that I needed to do multiple practices, or even if that I wanted to do multiple practices, what would be important is to engage with each one 100% wholeheartedly and just do that in that moment. And maybe the next moment or the next day I'm doing a different practice, but I have to 100% do that. And this is not different than the way we have to live anyway, right? We're always saying we have to engage 100% in walking the dog or doing our taxes or whatever it is. So this is not different, but I think that's where I was going with that answer. So I'm not sure if that's helpful to you, but I felt like the last time there was something missing in my answer. I think that's where I'm going. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, very helpful. Because where I left it, you know, it's like if you can manage both, great. And it was kind of like, you know,
but how
good luck with that.
Obviously
you can.
Right. Well, and I too felt like there was something missing, and so I wanted to come back, and I was hoping you would be here today so we could like briefly just revisit it. And I think that's where I was. I mean, like, I had an answer, but I didn't articulate it very well. So I wanted to.
Well, it seems like that's the only thing you could do, really.
Well, but I think,
you know, like, if you sit down to do insight meditation, for instance, then you're not doing Zazen.
No, but you need to be clear about that.
And if you're doing Zazen, and if you start thinking about insight meditation, then you're not doing Zazen anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think there's no way to do but that.
That's right, but I think we're not. Yes. I think it's easy to sort of lose sight of that. Especially if we have bodily habits where, you know, I always sit down for X number of minutes a day and do Vipassana, and today I'm going to sit down and do Zazen, my body's going to revert, you know. It's really easy, I think, to get muddy. So then we have to have a really clear intention. Today I'm sitting down to do insight meditation, you know. This is how I'm going to do it, and I'm going to 100% do that, and I'm not going to worry about the fact that, you know, there's a sutra that talks about this, which is different than Bogen's interpretation, and I mean, your mind can kind of go, woo! So, you know, I think it's possible to go in all of those multiple gateways if we're really clear and we're very intentional and we know what we're sitting down to do and we know how it might be different than what we're sitting down to do the next day. This is why it might be a bit of a challenge. So, you know, all of those practices might be very helpful, but I think we need to be careful not to kind of muddy the water.
Isn't there another thing, maybe I'm not quite on that same track, but isn't there another thing that can happen with multiple, is the ego can...
Oh, you bet.
It's like, well, I feel this way today. Mm-hmm. I think I'll... This is what can happen to me, you know, of course, is that I'm going to hook onto this track. This is the truth. Mm-hmm. But it's really supporting an ego that wants something.
You bet.
To be gratified in something.
You bet. It's exactly picking and choosing.
That's the danger.
That's
I
right.
I think you can do that,
yeah.
Probably, but I know that when I've tried to do that, there's an amazing conflict there. And so all the energy is just...
That's right.
Because it's like... I don't want to accept that. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't feel good to me or whatever.
Exactly.
So that's where I find...
That's right. Because we're, you know, it's just spiritual materialism. You know, we're grasping. Well, this isn't good enough. I'm going to go on to something else. Well, that's not working today. I'm going to try something else.
Yeah.
Can we stick with the fact that whatever the practice is, be it Zazen or Vipassana or anything else, can we stick with the fact that some days we're not comfortable? You know, our practice is not here to make us happy and comfortable. If it's not challenging us sometimes... What's going on? So there are going to be days where I don't feel like sitting down, but I'm going to do it. Or I really feel like today I'd rather be doing yoga, but this is my Zazen day. Whatever it is, I don't know. However people are kind of putting their practice together. But I think, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There
may
be a lot of ego-driven...
And I didn't realize it
until
I made the clear choice. And I went, my God, that's where I was spending all that conflict.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
On the other hand, you know, it's like there's the whole area of skillful means.
Yes.
And so, for example, who's that guy, Shinzen Young, has developed a form of Vipassana that's very good with physical and emotional pain. And works better than Zazen in terms of a skillful,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. But again, let's look at what the outcome is. You know, I'm sure all the practices have different kinds of outcomes, too. So let's use the right thing for the right outcome. You know, he might have a wonderful practice for a particular outcome, and it's great. Absolutely right. But again, it's part of, let's be clear about what's our intention, what are we sitting down to do, and then 100% do that at the time that's appropriate to do that. But not to muddy the water, I think, can be kind of hard. Because we're looking for something, you know? Well, this piece of this practice feels important, and that piece feels meaningful, and this piece is a lot of fun. I don't want to give that up.
I mean, to me, it's almost easier just to pick one.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
You know, mm-hmm. and not that one's better than the other. Just
no.
find something, well, for me, this is what I had to do, is just find something I felt good with and comfortable and felt, you know, and I'm like, okay, I'm sticking on this one. You know, as opposed to, something like, and I'm not dissing anyone, the Unitarian Church. I have tons of friends that go there. It's great. For me personally, that is, you know, a lot of different things. And I understand it's like this accepting thing and it's tolerant, and I love that part of it. But for me personally, for picking a one religion, I just had to go, okay, you know what? Soto Zen is for me. And sometimes I don't like it all the time, like you said. I don't like this chanting stuff. You know, I mean, there's certain things in there that I pick and choose for sure. I'm definitely the Zazen junkie, and if above everything else, I'd rather do Zazen. But I realize that, you know, there are other practices in it, and it's kind of, I don't know, there's something about them to make me sit down and chant and do some things that I wouldn't normally do. It's kind of part of just staying on that. But, you know, it's an individual thing, and I'm not getting down on someone else. I mean, that's just my personal... Mm-hmm. what I had to do.
And how can you say, you know, it's hard to know how much choice is actually in that, because you might have, like, lifetimes of momentum of sitting.
Causes and conditions.
Yeah, which, you know, guides your choice.
Yeah, I'm sure my whole life, I mean, aren't we all the sum of everything that's ever happened to me? You know, it's what makes us who we are, the good, the bad, the rid of, you kind of just gotta deal with it. I guess live with it.
100%.
I was going to ask a question. You were speaking about intention, and I was just, the first thing I think of when you speak about intention and focus and direction is how does that relate to the wandering mind's violation of that intention, and then the ego of self getting allowing this turbulence to arise, or just this turbulence arising from the disparity between the intention and the wandering mind's violation of that intention.
Well, we can have intention, but we can't be attached to the outcome. Every moment we have that intention, you know. So here's this intention, intention, intention. Now what actually happens with that, maybe we can't control. Or maybe we're getting more skillful at controlling, or not, you know. But when we don't get the outcome we expect, we've got to leave it alone. We maintain the intention, we renew the intention. It's just like Zazen, coming back, coming back, coming back, coming back. So we set a good intention, we do our best, we engage 100%, and if we still have this distraction, this turbulence, as you put it, in the mind, such that we don't kind of end up where we expected to.
Just let it go under the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And maintain the intention. And that's not always easy. Sometimes that's a huge challenge, you know, to maintain that intention, to live by vow. Is not easy. That's why this is a lifelong practice, and it's why it's helpful to be engaged with other people on this path and have all of these kind of supports, because we're going to fall off. We just are. We're human beings, but we can't beat ourselves up for that. We have to make our best effort and maintain the intention and let go of the outcome.
Do you think that Western people kind of have their, I don't know what you want to call it, place of orientation in their head as opposed to Eastern people? And I've noticed in myself, when I'm avoiding my body, almost energetically, my head is going to be spinning more thoughts. I might have this, like, oh, there's an anxiety or a sorrow I don't want to feel just by habit. And it's like, by not feeling it, it's like, zzz, you know?
Sure.
And then if I can feel it, it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like hydraulics.
Mm-hmm. Sure, because imagine all the energy and the effort that your mind, your intellect is putting into throwing up distractions so that you don't deal with whatever the pain is that you have. And we see that, I mean, Zazen is the ideal place to see that. Suddenly we don't have all the distractions of life. We can't distract ourselves with television and chocolate and, you know, all the things that we use. And we can see how the mind is throwing up these things. And, you know, we have to have compassion for that, because that's a defense mechanism. That's your body and your mind doing what any living creature will do, and that's avoid pain. I mean, it makes perfect sense. You know, any practically invertebrate animal will do that. So, I mean, it's a really old impulse, and we have to have compassion for that. But, you know, as someone who spent many, many years avoiding my body, and I still, my body awareness is very low. That's my temperament, but I'm aware of that, you know, and it means I live in my head. And a big part of my practice has been understand that there's more to you. There's more going on for you than simply whatever story is going on up here, whatever information and pictures and rationalization and justification and all kind of stuff is going on in the head. And, you know, that's really where I think Vipassana practice can be a wonderful help, especially for people, and I haven't done it extensively, but especially for people with really low body awareness, because it really shows you how any sensation in your body, you're putting a label on it, and then you're cutting yourself off. Gee, I've got some uncomfortable feeling in my body. My brain says, oh, that's despair. And then it shows, whatever. And then throws up a lot of stuff so that I don't have to deal with my despair. Well, if I go back and take that apart, I see form, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness right there. You know, I had some sense contact with something. I had some feeling in my body. What did I do with that? I recognized, oh, that must be, give it a name, despair. Oh, I don't like despair, so I'm going to go somewhere else. And right there we see how these things arise. I mean, in one moment of time, in a very simple way, we see how all of these things. So if we're not aware of what's going on in the body, if we can't reduce ourselves to saying, that's a sensation, I'm not going to label it, I'm not going to judge it, I'm not going to avoid it, I'm going to 100% simply be that. And heck, it doesn't kill us. You know? Ultimately, it's okay. It's a very interesting practice.